Have you ever tried to help someone only to have your advice fall flat or backfire completely? In today's episode, you'll learn a powerful way to support your team, your colleagues, even your clients without solving the problem for them. It's a mindset shift, a language upgrade, and a communication tool all in one sentence. Welcome to the Fluent Edge podcast, the show for global professionals who want to lead, speak, and succeed in English and in life. I'm Sean Watson, business English coach and co-host of this show.
And I'm Dr. Howie Jacobson, leadership coach and author. Each week, we bring you practical tools and smart strategies to help you communicate clearly and lead with confidence.
Today, I'm interviewing Howie about one of the biggest mistakes we make when trying to help: giving advice too early. We'll explore why that backfires and how to lead with questions instead. This episode is based on Howie's article on Substack, where he breaks down 7 techniques for helping someone get unstuck without hijacking the conversation. You'll find the link in the show notes, and you can subscribe to get more tools like these delivered each week. So Howie, why is giving advice, especially early in a conversation, often counterproductive, even when it's well-intentioned?
When we give someone else advice, we're saying the advice, but we're also saying something else. There's another message, a tag attached to that message. And the tag is, I'm superior to you, at least in this moment, about this issue. I know more than you. I am above you. Now, sometimes that's fine. If you're the teacher and someone else is the student, which you are in a position where they have agreed they're paying you to be superior to them in business English. But when you're working with people out in the wild, when you're working with your team, with your family, with friends, you don't want to be the know-it-all. And the reason you don't is because people react negatively to being told that they are less than. It feels like criticism. If I say, you know what, Sean, let me tell you what you should do, and you haven't asked me, and I just jump in with, here's what you should do, you immediately feel a certain energy around that.
Mm-hmm. Good point.
I'm aware as I talk to you, because of your vast experience with other cultures, that this is nuanced, and that parts of this will apply more to certain cultures and less to others. But I think in terms of a global default, where I don't know who's going to be in the room, it's going to be someone from Buenos Aires, someone from Hamburg, someone from Dublin, that I think the safest thing is to be more of a questioner and a supporter rather than an advice giver.
Excellent.
Even if you ask me for advice, I don't want to jump in with it right away, because one of the things I want to do is help the people around me develop their own independent capability. Let's say I'm the boss and I'm the leader of this team. And I got that position because I'm really good at what I do, right? I'm really smart. And I am proud of that. And my team knows that I can solve any problem they bring to me. I'm a better coder. I'm a better salesperson.
Right.
And so what are they going to do? They're going to keep bringing me their problems. I'm going to solve them. I feel good when I solve it because I'm smart and I'm doing what I'm good at. They feel good that I solved it because they don't have to. They can get right back to work. Everybody wins, except now I'm the bottleneck. Right?
Gotcha.
That's a nice idiom. I wonder how other languages say that concept of bottleneck.
Maybe we should ask people to put that in the comments for this episode. What is bottleneck in your language? Yeah, and also just to be a bit of a language nerd, I noticed that you use the compound noun know-it-all, and that is probably a new noun for most of the people I work with to see that. So in English, with adjectives and nouns, you can often combine multiple words to create what we call compound nouns or compound adjectives. For example, fire truck, that would be an example of a compound noun because fire and truck are both nouns that create a new noun together.
I just learned a Spanish word like that, a puzzle. Is a rompecabezas, which means break heads.
That's great.
And it sounds so weird to me. And I guess that's how know-it-all could sound to someone for whom English is a new language.
Perfect. I love how descriptive that is in Spanish of breaking your head with a puzzle. That's great. Cool. So you talk about activating ownership and emotional courage. How do those shift the dynamic of a coaching or leadership conversation.
Yeah, so both of those are really important if we want to help people change and grow. If you want someone to change, and by change, I mean very broadly, to get better at what they do, to improve a skill, to behave in a new way. Very often, the smartest people in an organization get promoted to leadership. They've never been trained in leadership. They've never been trained in management. All of a sudden, all of their brilliance is not helping them. In fact, it's even getting in the way because they keep wanting to go back and do the thing they're good at instead of this new thing, helping other people. So change can be difficult. So if we want to support someone's change, we need to know what they need. What are the powers they need to draw upon in order to change? One of them is ownership, which is to say, I want to be this new thing. We see this in schools. I was a school teacher for many years, and the kids come in, they don't want to learn math. And it's my job to teach them math. The best teachers, the ones that win the awards, are the ones who are so engaging and entertaining that they can make kids learn what they don't want to learn.
Very nice.
When we're adults, we get to decide. And if I want to move into this new role, okay, what I need to be able to do is run a meeting. I've never run a meeting before. I have to want to. So that's ownership.
Right.
If I just give it to you, if I just tell you what to do, or I say, Sean, here's what you're doing wrong in meetings. You need to start with an icebreaker. Instead of saying, Sean, tell me about the meetings that you have really enjoyed. Tell me about the leaders. Tell me about a meeting that felt really valuable. Then you're coming up with the ideas. And if you say, I think I want to start with a little icebreaker where everyone, icebreaker might be another fun word.
Yeah.
Right? Where everyone talks about what their week for a couple of minutes or a movie they saw or their favorite song. And then you've said it. You now own it rather than me giving it to you.
Right.
And the other one is emotional courage, which is acknowledging that change is hard. And I have to be willing to be a beginner again. Everyone who's watching this podcast or listening has emotional courage around speaking English. I clench my butt cheeks when I have to speak in Spanish because it's so scary for me.
Right.
And I'm scared I'm going to make mistakes. So it's easier to not speak.
Right.
Just hold up my phone with a Google Translate.
That's right.
And say,
Yeah. And we do have this technology coming. I've seen prototypes of earbuds you can wear that spontaneously translate when you're talking with another person, which is pretty cool. But let's hope that the ancient art of learning a second or third or fourth language doesn't become completely taken over by technology. I think it's really good. I know it's good for the human brain to learn other languages, right? They say it can even delay Alzheimer's later on in life.
I'm just imagining a couple who are married for 10 years, only speaking with these earbuds, the power goes out, the internet goes down, and they're staring at each other, trying to communicate with the gestures and hand signals.
That's
and
right.
Grunts.
That's when the language of love comes in, maybe. Yeah. So one of your techniques is asking, what might you try? Why is that specific wording so effective?
The word try has gotten a bad rap. I've heard so many people quoting Yoda from one of the Star Wars movies. I think it was the second one. It says, do or not do, there is no try. Luke is trying to use the Force to pull the ship out of the swamp or whatever. Right. He's like, I'm trying. And Yoda says, do or not. So try gets a bad rap. But try in English has these two different meanings. Try could mean to taste. Like, oh, try this. And try could also mean intend to, put effort into. And when I say, what might you try? I am speaking of the first one, of what might you taste? What might you taste? Because that allows people to think without front-loading commitment. So Sean, if I say, what are you going to do?
I'm already anxious when somebody says that. I feel the pressure, like somebody's pushing me.
Yeah. So at this point, when we're brainstorming, the quantity of total ideas is the best predictor of the quality of the idea that ends up being chosen.
That's lovely.
The more, the better. So the more I can lower the bar, lower the standard by which you have to, if I say, what might you try? And you say, well, I could try to start the meeting by having everyone stand on their chair. And I say, Sean, that's stupid. If I've judged you, am I going to get another option out of you?
Right. This whole idea of what might you try is great for language learners as well, right? If you're trying to have a conversation with somebody and something doesn't come out or you're afraid to try something, instead of saying, oh, I screwed up again, or maybe framing it rather than self-criticism of saying, okay, maybe that didn't pan out correctly, but what might I try? I love that. I think that could easily be applied to language learners.
Yeah, and I think even speaking in your own language, we are improvising.
Yes.
Almost every conversation that's not a script is an improvisation. So whether I'm improvising in my native tongue or in another language, I'm always trying. In communication skills training, we talk about bids. In couples therapy, they talk about bids. What are you bidding? Almost like you're playing a game of poker or hearts.
Interesting.
And you place your bid, and then your partner, your conversation partner, receives it or rejects it, deflects it, responds. And so you can think about trying things like playing a card and seeing how they play, or making a move in chess.
Yeah. So the word might, for those who have studied English grammar, falls into the category of a modal verb, right? So we have other similar ones that we use to soften our tone or to invite collaboration. So it could be something like, we could consider this possibility, right? So could is another good modal verb to use to soften your tone. So might, could, would, if you're asking somebody to do something, would you mind not smoking in front of me, for example, instead of saying, stop smoking? So these are really good at bringing a little bit more nuance into what we ask or what we invite people to do.
And I think might also leads to the subjunctive, right? I'm very subjunctive aware, struggling with it in Spanish, right? Like you would say, I do, you do, she does. But if I say, what might she do? So I think that makes it subjunctive because it's not a fact, it's a supposition.
That's right. Look at the hierarchy of what we call modals of possibility. We have may, which ranks above might when we're talking about something that could happen. Like if I say it may rain this afternoon, the likelihood or possibility is a little bit higher than if I say it might rain. So there's a little bit of nuance there, even between those two modal verbs, just in case somebody's asking.
I'm learning at least as much business English as anybody who's watching this podcast.
Right.
It's amazing how little awareness I have over my own language.
Well, I think in North America, I don't think teachers really spent a lot of time helping us understand the nitty-gritty of grammar. They kind of fast-tracked us to spelling and advanced vocabulary, but they never really gave us the skeleton of the language, the foundation, the rudiments. Was it different in the U.S., or was that the same for you?
Yeah. No, I got a lot of gritty, but no nitty.
Very nice. Good. So what's the power of asking, what's the scariest option you can think of? And how can that help someone move forward?
So I would do this after several rounds of what might you try? The context is they'll have said a few things. The first couple of things people say are usually things they've already thought of. It's almost like you turn on the tap after you've been away for a couple of weeks and brown sludge comes out until it runs clear. So the first few ideas people have are usually things they've already thought of, and they probably haven't worked. You continue asking various questions to get more options on the table. So you might add constraints, for example. What if you had to do it by tomorrow? What if you couldn't hire anybody new? What if you couldn't travel, right? A lot of people changed their business models drastically during COVID because of constraints, and they discovered they liked it better. You could take away constraints. What if you had $1 million? What would you do? There's a beautiful question. What would you try if you knew you could not fail? The question of what's the scariest thing you could imagine, it expands the possibilities beyond what they might have thought about. It's giving them permission to think about things that might scare them. But here's the key. The things that scare us are very often the things that we really want to do or should do. It's scary because it's asking me to go beyond what I know. It's scary because I'm putting myself out in front of other people. It's usually not scary because someone might punch me in the face. We're scared of a feeling. And I like to use the feelings that I'm scared of almost to move in that direction. I don't want to be scared of my feelings. I want to be able to feel everything and be able to then make a decision based on what's the best thing to do, not what's going to make me feel most comfortable. That's why I love that question.
Excellent. Is there a risk of helping people too much, even when you've got good intentions? And how can leaders know when to step back instead of stepping in?
Yeah, there's always a risk of helping too much. There's a risk of helping too little. One of the things I would say is if you're in conversation, if you're in dialogue, you can ask. And I had this with, well, when my kids were little and they had homework and they would tell me, you know, I really need help. I don't understand this long division problem. And I would help them say, okay, that's enough. Let me do it. Open communication is important because we never get this right. Relationships aren't things you win. They're experiences to go through.
Mm.
But I would say also, you want to think about the task versus the future.
Mm.
If someone's lying on the ground and their leg is broken, you want to help them get up. You don't want to say, well, let's talk about rehabilitation. You want to help them up. You want to get them crutches. You want to get the bone set. You want to get antibiotics. You want to get, you know, want to get them comfortable. And then we can talk about, well, let's see what caused this fall. And let's, you know, is it a matter, is it a balance issue, workplace safety issue? But let's first deal with the thing.
Mm.
But there's other times where it's more important to increase capability for the future. Like you have a sales presentation to give. It's an important presentation, but it's important enough that I might think, well, I should just do it for you because we want the sale. We want the revenue. We want the business. But also I want to be promoted to CEO, which means I want you to be promoted to my position, which means the long-term better investment is to get you ready, even if you don't make this particular sale.
So if someone hears an idea that feels totally unrealistic, but exciting, how can they stay open to it without feeling irresponsible?
I was just coaching somebody on this about an hour ago, and we got to the metaphor of a casino. Someone goes to a casino, presumably for entertainment purposes, right? I hope people aren't going to the casino to make money to pay the rent. It's entertainment. But what separates the people who might lose a few hundred dollars, who might win a few hundred dollars, who have fun, who get that thrill of excitement, from the people who leave without their pants? The people who play responsibly have a stop loss. They have decided the point at which they're going to quit. So you and I had this idea for this podcast. We're putting in a fair amount of effort every week. We're coming up with material, preparing it, talking to each other, recording. We're learning how to edit, promote and market it. It's not an insignificant investment.
Mm-hmm.
We want to have a stop loss. Let's say we do 20 episodes and we have 9 subscribers. We might say, Sean, this is great. I really love doing this and it's not worth it. You know, it was a crazy idea. We thought the world loved it, but we were wrong, so let's stop. Or we could keep going for 500 episodes, 1,000 episodes, because we don't have a stop loss. So I would say, figure out what the result of the experiment would be that would say, okay, I experimented, I learned, and I'm cutting it off.
Right. So for me, as a language coach and communication coach, I would just say that for any of you working in cross-cultural situations or virtual teams, just remember that how you ask can be just as important as what you ask. When English is your second or third language, it's important to know what is the best way to invite somebody to collaborate. What is the best way of saying it?
Yeah, I just wanted to add one thing to that, which is in most English-speaking cultures, it's okay to ask about your communication style. Say,
good
hey,
point.
Can you tell me if I'm too direct or too indirect? English speakers tend to love that level of meta conversation, which is conversation about conversation. There's a wonderful scene in one of my favorite television shows of all time, Ted Lasso.
We're waiting for the next season. It's coming soon.
Yeah. So the scene is they're talking about a loss they've just had. And one of the players says, we played so terribly. We made so many mistakes. And the Dutch guy, Jan Maas, says, I didn't make any mistakes. You made the mistakes. And everyone's like, gets bristles. And then Sam, the player from Nigeria, says, hey guys, Jan Maas isn't rude. He's just Dutch.
Right.
And
that's
then everyone nods and says, oh, okay. Yeah. And there's no more tension. To acknowledge and say, I may sound like I'm fluent in the language, but can you give me feedback if I'm coming across too harsh or not clear enough? I think English speakers tend to be very comfortable with that level of conversation.
Absolutely. Your Fluent Edge challenge this week, when someone brings you a challenge, resist the urge to fix it and try asking, what might you try instead? Many of our listeners do not have English as a first language, and that's one of the purposes of this podcast, to help people advance their English language skills. Try recording yourself saying the question a few times with different tones. You could try with a bit of curiosity, sound more supportive or more relaxed. You might be amazed at how much this can boost your overall fluency and the effectiveness of what you communicate.
I love that. You could also play with accenting a different word in the sentence.
Indeed.
What might you try? Or what might you try?
But that reminds me a bit of the famous American actor Christopher Walken. You know how he talks with that weird punctuation. He emphasizes the wrong word sometimes, and that's become his trademark. But you're absolutely right. And that's something that I work on quite frequently, especially with Chinese speakers, Japanese speakers, Korean speakers. It's very difficult for them to figure out sometimes what are the key words in a sentence. Which words should I stress, depending on my intention, what it is that I'm trying to communicate? For me, it's very similar when I try to learn the different tones in Chinese. Some of my Chinese students try to teach me the difference between ma, 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 like all of this tonality, and I have to hear it over and over again to really differentiate.
That's very cool. If you are looking for support beyond the podcast, we've each opened up spots for one-on-one coaching. I work with professionals and leaders who want to avoid burnout, lead with purpose, and shift their mindset for sustainable success. If that's you, you can book a free discovery call using the link in the description. And to you, Sean.
And if you're working on your English clarity, global presence, or confident communication, book a free discovery call with me to explore how we can sharpen your voice and impact together. So subscribe, share, and check the description for your downloads and tools.
And until next time, keep thinking clearly, communicating boldly, and leading with your voice.
Stay sharp, stay human, stay fluent.